Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Real Scotland Blethers, the podcast of realscotland.com that's dedicated to covering all aspects of film and TV in Scotland, past, present and future. My name's Jonathan Melville and I'm the editor of realscotland.com, and in this podcast I speak to people who have some connection to filmmaking, films and TV in Scotland. They don't actually have to be Scottish films or TV, but if they've been shown here they might feature on the podcast or the website. You can find out more about the podcast on Facebook by searching for Real Scotland, that's R-E-E-L, Scotland, or on Twitter at Real Scotland. You can also email me via realscotland@gmail.com. Last week I spent some time at the Edinburgh International Film Festival, where one of the new films I saw was a documentary Time Trail from Edinburgh director Finlay Pretzel. The film follows former professional cyclist David Miller as he fights to return to racing following a tumultuous career that involved winning numerous titles before being suspended for doping in 2004. Now clean, Miller's journey to compete again in the Tour de France is caught on camera in sometimes painful detail, and as a viewer you're taken inside the race by Finlay's cameras.
I've written books, spoken at conferences, done about 1,000 interviews. It's not real anymore, so it doesn't mean anything.
I have the most vivid dream.
I was with my best friend. We were up to some tall building. I pushed him off. I spent the rest of the dream trying to get down the building to get to him.
You won in 2003 on drugs. You won as a cheat.
It's a great film, and as this episode is published on the 2nd of July, there's still time to see it in UK cinemas before it comes out again on the 12th of July around the UK. I spoke to Finlay about how the film came to be, and I think there's some good advice in there for anyone thinking of making a documentary. The interview took place in the bar of Edinburgh's Cameo Cinema, so apologies for some of the background noises, which at one point get a little bit loud, just for a few seconds.
I'm delighted if lots of cyclists come on. It's great. I really hope they do, and I think they will. But I'm desperate for people who are not interested in cycling to go in and go on the ride.
Because it's a film, obviously, about... I mean, you can tell us or tell me a bit more about what it is about, but it's about a person, really. I mean, okay, your cycling is what he does, David Miller, but... The whole thing really is about his, inside his head, isn't it? And his life and his experiences and his amazing story, really, of going from this guy that's at the peak of his career to
being
without a spoiler. You know, it's not really spoilers, I suppose, is it, to say it didn't work out for him?
No.
Certainly when he had his fall from grace.
Yeah.
So it is a cycling film, but it isn't.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is the point of any great documentary, isn't it? It's, you can take the lessons or the learnings, I suppose, to into any anyone can take that. So as you say, you don't have to, of course it'd be great, and if you do cycle I think you'll definitely get something out of that. But even as a amateur like me, just seeing what it's like on a race when these guys having a chat, even, or he's got to take his jacket off and get his gloves on,
which is bizarre.
So that's fascinating. But on the other hand, it's about a guy who messed up, and, I suppose, and then tried to make things better.
Yeah, and coming to the end of your career, and I think we all
definitely.
I don't think my age, 39, I'm thinking about coming to the end of my career yet, but I can imagine that. I feel it with him. It's this. He was 37 when he, like, in his last year of racing, and it's not. He wanted to go out as anyone would, in your the best, you know, any job. You want to go out on a good level. You know, you want to go out. You've made a difference, and I think with him, it was a slow fade out without giving the film away. And I think that's much more tangible to audiences than the big blaze of glory or the absolute fatal demise, you know? It's like this kind of like, okay, that's it, you know? Like a candle blowing out or something, you know? Without trying to be poetic.
Yeah.
But it's like that, it's a slow fade out, and it's like, that for me is way more fascinating as a human condition and being on this journey with someone. I think cause it's far more subtle and far more real, I think. Actually.
Yeah, because you could, part of you, I think, going into this, or I, not consciously, but you do sort of think, okay, this will be like a Rocky story, like a, he's trying to get to the top, there'll be a few missteps, but of course he'll do it and he'll be all happy at the end.
Exactly.
And no, as you say, there's a bit of a sort of a fade out here.
Yeah.
But how did you get him to be so open to being followed around? Because there's a few scenes in there that feel awkward, and I think as an audience member, you're a bit like, oh, you can sort of feel what you were feeling when you're asking him about the tough questions, and one, at least once he sort of says, I'm not answering that.
Yeah.
And you can feel the tension.
Absolutely. But that, with David and I think he, I think there was, there's always been a bit of a tension between us, I think.
When did you first, did you approach him or did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, how did that happen first?
Well, I approached him like in 2006. I made a short film. Adrian McDowell and me made this like short film called Standing Star. He's a velodrome cyclist, contemporary with Chris Hoy, called Craig McLean, world champion, Olympic cyclist, fantastic bike rider, in a velodrome, 12 minute long, and I suppose at that point I was like, velodrome cycling was never any interest to me. It's always been the road cycling, which seems more mystical and magical and strange in a way, and so much more of a commitment, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, so I saw David while doing this, making this film, and I thought, oh, maybe. I've always known him, I've always followed his career, all the rest of it. But I thought, I saw him while making this film, and I thought, oh, actually, maybe he could do this film about the road cycle. The film about the experience of a race came first. And then I thought David might be that person to tell the story in a way. So I made sure he got this copy of this DVD. And then we met at this cycling dinner in Scotland called the Braveheart Dinner. It's like a fundraising dinner where he was going to be at. We met and we talked all night, like literally all night until the morning, about what we can do and how we can make it work. And I think from that moment on, I thought, yeah, he wants to go the distance. He wants to try things. He wants to like make this happen, you know, and not in a way he wants to control everything you're doing and say, well, we should do this, we should do that, we shouldn't do this, and I'm gonna edit this, and I don't want you to show that. He was very just open, and so he was up for it. However, that's like 11, 12 years ago. We kind of had a pause. We didn't speak for a couple of years, or we kind of kept slightly in touch. And then we revisited the idea, and I thought, right, I need to make this happen, actually. Just after I made a film called Cutting Loose about a prison hairdressing competition, which is claustrophobic, complete claustrophobia in every way possible. You're in jails, you know, and they're... And David Miller and all the cyclists are in these beautiful, wide-open landscapes. But actually, they don't see any of that. They're just in this locked bubble, as in the film. It's very claustrophobic as well. They're kind of imprisoned by cycling, about racing. They don't know anything else, you know? And I think, and it's almost worse than being in prison, you know, in a sense. Not really, but you know what I mean. And I think that... So I then started speaking to him, went on many, like, recces to the Tour de France, Tour of Oman, like, countless recces to see how we could get... what access we could get, how we could just get... what we could get away with. Always making these contacts with people while you're doing that. Because it's a really difficult world to penetrate. It's like horrendously difficult. And I think that's why we're always trying to like push and fight our way in. And I think because of that time we spent doing that, that's how we got that access. And all the while, I'm speaking to David. David's having to negotiate things and do this, and which is difficult for him to do, you know, because he's got a job to do.
Yeah.
And but he was always, he would always do it. He'd always make it happen, you know. And I think by, in many ways, I think he would always, he, while doing these interviews, I would feel very uncomfortable, you know, because also he is somebody that I've followed for many years, just as a fan of cycling. And I would see him and I, suddenly he's right in front of me and he's staring at me, wanting me to come up with something, you know, in a strange way.
Yeah.
But I think also he felt that pressure also of me, of him agreeing to making this film and knowing that he is the centre of it and he has to make it interesting. So I think there's this strange dynamic between us. There's no one else in the film.
Yeah.
Him. And of course his teammate Thomas Dekker, who is, loves the camera and plays up to it and is a completely different character to David. So I think it was this, always that tension, which I think worked really well, and it was, it's really difficult at times as well. You've also got to remember that he stayed on board with the project for so long, to be fair to him, you know, and he never ever said no. There was a couple of things that I would ask him to do and he would be like, oh, this just feels strange. Fair enough, but
he like a bit too staged maybe, or
yeah,
a bit stagey.
Kind of, or like he wouldn't quite get the idea, and I think it was like maybe a slightly half-baked idea of mine that I'd be like, oh, let's try this out, and he just felt very uncomfortable with it, which is totally understandable. But like, I mean, that was probably once or twice that happened. It was so little. So I think that's what I originally liked about him, because he's very, he's got this Calvinistic nature that he'll be like, right, whatever happens, happens, and that's it. And I like that. It's that, that's kind of exciting in a way. It's like he'll just let you do, not whatever, because he's a strong character, but he would allow you, and he would somehow understand the process, although he didn't know what the process was. And he, you know, he said this other night, there was times we would be round at his house, a few of us, you know, me, Martin Radich, the DOP, Douglas Fairgreave, who's the sound guy, and we'd sit around and there'd be nothing to film. But we would be sitting there going, yeah, yeah. And I wouldn't, if I'm honest with you, we had a very rough schedule. And what we didn't, I remember there was just this particular time we were there with him for 5 days, just David and us three, at his house in Spain, in the middle of like July, middle of July. It was baking hot. We couldn't do anything during the day. There was we couldn't actually do the things that we'd planned because it was so hot. So it kind of threw us a bit. We were like, oh, I don't know what we're going to do this afternoon. So we'd go round to his house and kind of sit around and be like,
hope this one would happen.
And nothing would some days. And that makes somebody like these athletes, they operate in ones and zeros, you know, they're very analytical and they have schedules, and filmmaking's all grey area, you know, it's really, you operate in the margins of everything. So and he went along with it, so I think that's quite I knew he would. I've always known that he would, you know,
and he did, trusted me.
Did he have any say over the editing or the final cut? Did you ever want that, or
nah, never. We always agreed that that wouldn't ever happen. But he also never tried to push it. We showed him a kind of early-ish rough cut. I just wanted to reassure him, you know? And it was like, he said a few things. He was uncomfortable with certain things. And he did say one point that was totally like, Yes, that I totally agree with that, actually. And it was about clarifying his anger. We all had to realise why he was angry. And he didn't want people just to feel sorry for him at the end of the film. And I'm like, yeah, that I get that. In that previous cut, it wasn't coming through so much, you know. And now, I think that point was, took it on, you know. If we hadn't done anything, he wouldn't have said anything. He would have just gone along with it in a way. Maybe disagreed with it, but yeah. And yeah. I think he finds it very difficult to watch the film. Understandably, I think it shows up something that he can't ever talk about, I think, you know, and I think he would have preferred to have done better. And I think also it's quite tough for his family to watch as well, you know, in a way, because I think it uncovers something that is there, that is unsaid, you know.
It's fascinating.
Mm.
Is that the most you've ever spent with a subject on one of your films?
Oh, absolutely. Too right it was. Big time. I mean, it's like, yeah, and I can't actually imagine trying to do that again with one subject. I think that's really hard. It's massive pressure on both. Both people. That was high. It's huge pressure on each of you to rely on one person. And I think, way longer. I mean, yeah, I've made short films in the past with just... And that's difficult enough, you know? Because you don't actually just spend the time actually in that person's company. You've got them on screen all the time. And you're constantly talking about... that person,
yeah,
in almost everything you do to make that film, to finance it, to communicate to editors, cameramen, whoever. So it's like, it's endless. So you are watching that person. You feel like you're with them all the time, you know? And you get sick of those people, you know? You get tired of them. We get tired of each other,
yeah.
Me, David and I. And I think now we've kind of moved to another phase of things, actually. And I think it's definitely for the better.
Yeah.
And, yeah, no, I'm kind of amazed that we could remain friendly, actually, which we are. I mean, it's not difficult with each other, you know. We have, it's such a long time when you think in such an intense relationship, you know.
Yeah.
And the times that I think it's fine when you're shooting with somebody and you have a few crew members so they can talk to him and everyone else can get on, but there'd be times when, well, I suppose towards the end it was just me and him, like, and just doing an audio piece in a hotel room in the centre of London, you know. That is quite difficult, you know. It was quite a nice moment in a way, because it felt like I'd started just doing that with him, initially filming with him, just me and him, like right at the start, like in 2010, something like that. And so, like, fast forward on to 2017, we're sat in a hotel room, just me and him again. It was quite a nice moment in a way, but kind of awkward at the same time.
Yeah. And you still work at the Scottish Documentary Institute.
Mm.
And I guess you're working with, what's your job title there?
My job title technically is like head of distribution, but I produce other films as well.
Yeah. So, when you went into this, you obviously, I'm guessing you knew, maybe 10 years ago, maybe didn't know as much as you knew now, but I suppose it's. I'm just wondering about how much you learned yourself from doing this that you will then take back to your day job, basically.
Oh, for sure. It's like a massive amount. It, for every.
It's like work. It sounds a bit like work experience or something.
Yeah, no, and then you come back and you're like, oh, this is what I learned from this. Yeah, yeah. But it is. It's a massive learning thing, and I think that's why with the Documentary Institute, it's always been the case. We all work on films, whether it's production or directing. Well, I'm the only director really there, or Noe as well, but Noe's predominantly production. And I think that it's essential to put back into everything we do.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the amount of stuff from pre-production, financing, production, distribution, festivals, and it's a different thing, you know. Features, you know, I've only made short films, and yeah, we look after feature length documentaries, but not that hands on. Like, Time Trial was hands on, and it would, especially Sonia, the producer, and I, it was like, and you really realise what's going on and what it takes. And I think now it's that thing which you almost take for granted in some way, that the film gets out there and it does something. But actually that is it's so difficult to get a film seen, you know. In documentary, it's really hard to see documentaries and get documentaries to play in cinemas, I think, and I think that's right now what we're kind of dealing with. But yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, okay, you feel like there's too much to say on that, though, how much you bring back to the Documentary Institute. It's like massive, I think.
And do you think things have got better? I mean, how long have you been there now?
Oh, 12 years.
And do you think things, I mean, the SDI has since I've known it, which is maybe since about 2010 when I started doing Real Scotland, when I really started realising what was out there.
Yeah.
You guys, the name just seems to have got bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Do you think it's at a point now where it's, you know, every year it gets a bit bigger, or do you think have you had peaks and troughs? Or, you know, I suppose not just for you guys, but I mean documentary in general. I mean, how do you think it's?
Well, I think, because of SDI, I think there's the kind of community and what's actually happening in Scotland has definitely upped its game, you know, for definite. And I'm not sure that would have happened without us being present for all the masterclasses, the Edinburgh Pitch every year. This is the goal of SDI, was to create a documentary community in Scotland.
Yeah.
That was loud.
Yeah,
that's
all right.
Yeah,
it's all the sound effects.
It is. It's like a Foley studio.
Yeah. Record it for the next one.
Yeah, definitely. That was a good sound, though, of the barrel rolling.
That's a cracker.
But I think it's like, yeah, and I think it does get bigger every year, and I think we. It doesn't get easier, but no. I think it gets bigger, and I think we do more every year, and I think people start to take notice of what we're doing more, and I think we've kind of got a reputation around the world, probably, and especially in festivals and distributors and sales agents and stuff as doing good quality work. But I think it's not that funny. I'm telling the truth here. But I think it keeps getting growing, and I think there's so many more filmmakers. You know, Paul Feigen's film that came out, Where You Meant to Be, a couple of years ago. Emma Davies, I Am Breathing, and then another one, Becoming Animal. It feels like this. We've got another couple coming up, Freedom Fields. Nate Passeran is like, we have helped with that as well, and right from the get-go, and are starting to try and help get into festivals, and And it's like, this, yeah, this, it feels like there's so much going on, almost like too much.
Yeah.
And it, and I do believe that, yeah, SDI need, we need to shift into something else. Keep doing what we're doing, but shift into something else. And I don't know what I mean by that, but I think we, it's almost time for us to kind of come back and say, right, let's assess the last few years and make some adjustments.
Do you have things like Netflix taking on so many documentaries? Is that, have you noticed any kind of change in, I don't know, the reaction from either just friends or from the industry around yeah, yeah. sort of saying, okay, there's a chance now this could get on Netflix and it could get X million viewers. Yeah. Is that, are people a bit more aware of that now, maybe?
Well, I think the good thing with Netflix and what they do now is it's actually pushing the form of filmmaking or documentary making, especially, you know, with all these series and
10-part
yeah
series and things
yeah that can be very slow and yeah. very, like, you know, they take a long time, and I think that transfers into, it can transfer into cinema as well.
Definitely.
and making people kind of, oh, okay, I can take this on. And
well, it helps to kind of almost educate or teach people a little bit in a sort of sneaky way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you're just sitting at home on the couch watching Making a Murderer, you don't realise you're being taught anything, but you're kind of then learning to enjoy documentaries, I suppose, but also just that pace, that idea of coming back for another episode.
Yeah. No, but I think definitely it's also that suddenly it's given like a platform for like so many films, whereas I think a lot of the time it's always been like traditionally television money that funds documentaries, and it's like, oh well, cinema's so much the last thing a lot of broadcasters are wanting, so then suddenly Netflix, it doesn't matter, the film could be 3 hours long and they'll still play it if it's a good film, or shorter. It doesn't matter, and I think that's quite exciting. And people are going to Netflix rather than broadcasters, and I think that's or being forced into a slot that's on television that they have to watch at a certain time.
Yeah.
It's like you have this freedom now, and I think that's starting to kind of come out in the form of making films, and I think that's why people will be more open to watching more cinematic films.
So when you say you think the SDI maybe could look again or take another look at what it's doing, do you think is it things like that? Is it saying, okay, we've never thought of doing a 5-part TV series, but maybe we should be?
Absolutely, yeah.
Which 5 years ago you would not, have gone, nobody's going to watch that.
No, exactly. The longer documentaries, it's like, no way.
Yeah.
It's hard enough getting people to watch a short documentary and an extra short documentary. But I think now, we've been talking about that. But I still think that it's still a flooded market. There's still loads of other people making these films that have got really high production values, and they're, you know, Errol Morris, the series that he did recently. It's like a drama. It's a shot like a drama. And, you know, Herzog, did he have a series? Or he's, you know, made the kind of volcano film straight for Netflix. And I think this, I do think that there's a shift, but still, there's still a flooded market.
Yeah.
And I still think for us to get into that market of making these films, we still have to, like, up our game again to make it, you know, viable. But yeah, for sure.
So for new filmmakers, or even people who are just dabbling with their iPhones just now, what would you kind of, what's your a couple of simple pieces of advice for people who are thinking, oh, I'd love to do a proper documentary or just get into this world? What do you think? What's the first steps?
Well,
let's say in Scotland particularly, but generally I suppose it works as well.
Yeah, I think
whatever age, I mean, this could be someone in school or someone in their 50s, or?
Oh, I think to be absolutely critical and hard on yourself and question everything you're trying to do, every decision you make, and have a plan, have an idea. Or not just an idea, have a plan of what you're going to go out and shoot and what you're trying to say with it. I think that's the biggest thing. And I think it's always like, no one's going to be excited about your idea. Nobody. Until it's made, or until it's just before it's made, and then people will be excited about it. And don't let that put you off. And I think the biggest one is to forget things. Forget any negative stuff. Forget any bad shit that's happened. Just focus on that film, I think. But also, if there's any opportunities, Bridging a Gap is a great opportunity in Scotland as a professional development programme to, you know, to really nurture young or new filmmakers, I should say. Really.
Yeah.
And that we open calls for entry around about September, so they make short 10-minute documentaries. But it's also, they're people who have a background in filmmaking somehow, but if they can also provide some footage or, you know, or a previous film that can say, well, this is the style of, this is what I've done before, then it can definitely help their cause to make films. But,
cool. Yeah. Okay, well, I think we're coming to the end of our time.
Yeah, nice.
But when's the next screening of Time Chill? Have you got any more left in the festival?
Oh yeah, no, none in the festival.
No.
But we should, I should say, it comes into cinemas on the 29th of June for a week in Glasgow, Edinburgh, London, Belfast and Lewes, down in just outside London.
Right.
I've never heard of it either. And then it comes out again on the 12th of July.
Right.
Into about 80 cinemas all over the UK. So, like Scotland again, Edinburgh, Glasgow, and all over Scotland. So, yeah, so it'd be great, yeah.
Well, good luck with it.
Thanks very much.
Cheers for that.
Cheers.
Thanks to Finlay for taking the time to talk to me, and please try to see Time Trial at the cinema if you can. Until next time, thanks for listening to me blethering, and feel free to check out some previous episodes of the podcast at anchor.fm/RealScotland.